Welcome to our session on pleasure. I hope this session will not illustrate a fact that is often true about philosophy, that those who talk about ethics don't need to be ethical, and those who talk about pleasure don't need to be enjoyable. Books on aesthetics are seldom very pretty, and so on and so forth. There's a difference between talking about something and doing something, and often the differences are quite ironic. So I do hope you'll enjoy this session, but realize up front that it's not necessarily the case that you will. Today I want to talk about, first of all, Callicles from Plato's Dialogue to Gorgias, and then we'll talk about Epicurus, both of whom were advocates of the idea that the good life is a life of pleasure, of self-enjoyment. And there are two kinds of hedonists. The term for defining the good as pleasure is hedonism. The Greek word for pleasure is hedone, so hedonism just means pleasurism. And there are really two kinds of hedonists. The one kind is the fun sort of hedonist that defines pleasure pretty much the way anybody defines pleasure. You know, things that feel good. Wine, women's song, you know, that kind of hedonism. Tasty foods, sex, and on. All the stuff that makes you fat and gives diseases and things like that. All the stuff that leaves you with hangovers. These are the things that the happy hedonists advocate as the good life. Then there are the more, well, let's put it this way, ascetic, gloomy, mopey sort of hedonists who give a very, very special definition of pleasure that ends up boiling down to denying yourself most of the pleasures that that people recognize as pleasurable. And that, of course, is the view of Epicurus. Now, the word Epicurean has come to have a connotation of the sort of sumptuous, voluptuous kind of hedonism. And the main reason for that was when Epicureanism migrated to Rome in the first century BC, the Romans were just not of a temper, their temperament, to forego the pleasures of life. They had built up a rather large empire through strict virtue, and now that they had conquered most of the world, they wanted to have a good time. And so if you went to the house of a Roman who was prudish, self-controlled, and dignified, the chances are they were a Stoic. Okay. If Epicureanism was adopted anywhere in Rome, it was adopted by the bon vivants, by the pleasure seekers, by the people who gave big parties and big orgies. And so, for instance, one of the great works of first century Latin literature is Petronius's Satyricon. And Petronius, of course, was a sort of the poet laureate of Nero's court, which was renowned for its excesses of all sorts. And he was known as the arbiter of fashion, pleasure, and he lived a rather lavish and dissolute life, and it's recorded in the Satyricon, which is a wonderful work. Fellini, of course, did a movie called Satyricon. I couldn't watch it all the way through, though. I didn't find it very pleasurable, and I kept groaning at how awful the sets and everything were. I was such a stickler. I am such a stickler for historical accuracy that I'm always thinking, I wish Hollywood had called me about this. I would have straightened them out about some of these things. But anyway, the Satyricon is, if you will, the sort of encapsulation of Roman Epicureanism, voluptuous Epicureanism of Rome, the classic Epicureanism of the ancient Greeks. Was extremely ascetic and self-denying, because they had a very peculiar notion of pleasure. We're going to read Callicles, however, from Plato's Gorgias. I want to just go through this exchange between Socrates and Callicles from the Gorgias, and sort of lay this out, and then I want to look at Socrates' critique of Epicureanism, or hedonism. Epicurus hadn't been born yet when Socrates destroyed the basis for his teachings. he does it in this exchange with Callicles and the Gorgias. So this is the first bit of reading. So let's just begin. The starting point that we should look at first is on page 72. The issue that I find really interesting between Callicles on the one hand and Socrates on the other has everything to do with notions like order and harmony. Socrates is an advocate of the idea that happiness or well-being consists of the proper internal ordering or harmony of the soul. And Callicles is a person who is rather uninterested in this sort of notion. He is a person who defines the good life as a life in pursuit of power, power over other people, and the ability to satisfy one's desires by exercising that kind of power. If he can't, he would like to be a god, but if he can't be a god, he'll settle for being a tyrant, is the basic sort of attitude that Callicles has. And in order to become powerful in the city, Callicles has decided to study the art of rhetoric, the art of persuasion, because that's how you become powerful. You persuade people to do your bidding. And our politicians today know this quite well, too. And so Callicles has become a student of the Sophists. And the Sophists were a band of itinerant teachers of what we would call rhetoric and political science. The closest analogs to the Sophists today would be these political consultants like David Gergen and Dick Morris would be an example. These people are rather amoral and opportunistic, and they are masters, though, of creating impressions in the minds of the public of virtue on the part of politicians, and making it possible for politicians to persuade people to support them and do their bidding and advance their programs and so forth. So the spoon doctor is another person who would be a sort of student of the Sophists, right? And Callicles has gone to Gorgias because he wants to learn how to become powerful in the city through the manipulation of public opinion, basically. And in order to lead people, though, it turns out that you have to follow them. Nobody becomes a popular leader by standing up in front of the crowd and denouncing people's way of life and saying that they ought to be ashamed of themselves and they really should try and improve. But no one goes anywhere in politics by standing up and telling people that they're bad or they're mistaken or they're foolish or they should be ashamed of themselves and they ought to be better and that their priorities are out of whack and so forth. That's the quickest ticket to total political obscurity. So in order to lead people, you really have to follow them in the sense that you have to pander to their given preferences. And this is true in business, too. It's very hard to create demand for things that people have no known demand for. I've learned this trying to sell philosophy classes. There's very little you can pander to when you try and sell philosophy. About the best thing you can do is appeal to vanity. I know that's it's gotten you all. You want to feel superior to everybody else. But anyway, I'm teasing you, I hope. I hope I'm teasing you all. So Socrates poses, at the very beginning, a choice to Callicles. He says, there are two kinds of lives, Callicles. One is the life of the public man, the life you've chosen. And in order to lead this life, you have to constantly make sure that you are in harmony with all those who are around you, the public, the mob, the demos. The word demos, from which we get the democracy, is the Greek word for a mob, a large, unruly collection of people. And democracy literally means mob rule. And the word demagogue means leader of the mob. And what Callicles wants to be is a demagogue. Well, in order to be a demagogue, you have to put yourself in harmony with the opinions of the mob. But the trouble is that mob opinion is a constantly changing and fluctuating thing. This is why opinion polls are constantly going up and down, sometimes day to day, hour to hour. And our democracy has become so slavishly tied to public opinion that we're actually wiring people now, right? And measuring the tiny fluctuations of their opinions on a second by second basis as they watch proposed political ads or listen to candidates talking about issues. And the idea is that if you can somehow track the fluctuations of people's opinions moment to moment, that's the way to power. And that really is the way to power if you're trying to be a demagogue. But when you track it very precisely, you find that it's like this all the time. But is the truth like this all the time? No. And so the more slavishly politicians try and track public opinion, the further away they are from the truth, or any concern with the truth, which is really irrelevant. And one of the things that I think really has made George Stephanopoulos such a uninteresting political commentator is that he has absolutely no conception of truth. And so he shows up on This Week with Sam and Cokie, part of their roundtable, and he has no truth gene, or whatever it is. There's no part of his brain that registers the distinction between truth and falsehood. And so whenever they raise a question with him, it says, well, the American people want this, or the American people want that. And it just becomes totally uninteresting after a while. You could just press a button and play a video of him over and over and just retire him, So this is the disease of democracy, really, is a concern with following opinion. And the trouble with that, though, is that opinions aren't necessarily true. And that the more you are tying yourself to the day-to-day fluctuations of opinion, the less likely they are to be true. There are some opinions that are very ancient and long-standing. Opinions that have stood the test of time in one life and have been, therefore, bundled up and passed on to the next generation and so on and so forth. And very ancient opinions, time-honored opinions, traditions and so forth, are much more likely to be close to the truth than the day-to-day fluctuations of people's opinion based on whether they had a bad day at work, or whether they have an ingrown toenail, or whether they liked the president's hairdo, or something like that. So, opinion, though, as such, is not in any way an accurate indicator of truth, but some opinions are better than others, and the momentary fluctuation of opinion from moment to moment is not a very good sign of truth. And so what Socrates says to Callicles is, look, Callicles, what you have decided to do is put yourself in harmony with the people, and that means you're always going to be out of harmony with yourself. And also with the truth. Because the idea here is that human beings have character, a nature, temperaments, and so forth, and that there are also objective truths. And if you are not in harmony with those things, you're going to be, in some deep way, unhappy. If you live in a way that fundamentally diverges from your character and your temperaments, you're not going to be happy. And if you live a life as a stranger to truth, you're going to be unhappy. Whereas Socrates represents a different kind of life, the philosophic life. And the philosophic life is a life of pursuing harmony with oneself and the truth. And since people, by and large, are out of harmony with truth and out of harmony with you as an individual, they've got their own interests, their own games to play, the philosophic life is going to be a life that's going to bring you into conflict with other people. Now, you can do your best to avoid these conflicts by leading a private life. Right? But the worst thing to do is to be a philosopher and go out there in public, walking around beating a drum and announcing that the end is near, because then people are just going to hate you, because you're going to be out of harmony with them and in their face at the same time, and nobody likes that, right? On page 72, about six, seven lines down, Socrates says to Callicles, he says, my friend and comrade, philosophy always says what you now hear from me, and is much less capricious with me than the other boyfriend. He's referring to Alcibiades. For this fellow of Clinias's family presents various speeches at various times, whereas philosophy always presents the same and says what you now are amazed at, and you were present yourself to hear the thing said. So then either refute that one, as I was saying just a while ago, by showing that doing injustice and not paying the just penalty when one does injustice are not the utmost of evils. Or, if you leave this unrefuted, by the dog, the god of the Egyptians, Callicles, will not agree with you, Callicles, but will be dissonant in his whole life. Now, this is kind of hard to follow, I suppose, but what he's saying is, look, when you're confronted with the philosophical claim that Socrates has argued, and he's been arguing this claim, that it is better, if you have to choose, to suffer injustice than to do it. Callicles thinks that's preposterous, that it's better to suffer than to do injustice if you have to choose one or the other. Socrates is saying, look, Callicles, you don't refute this, you're not going to be in harmony with yourself. Callicles won't agree with Callicles, is what he's saying. And that's the worst kind of disagreement. And he goes on, so he says, Callicles will not agree with you, Callicles, but will be dissonant in his whole life. And yet I think, you best of men, it is superior that my lyre, okay, be his harp, be out of tune and dissonant, and the chorus I might provide for the public, and that most human beings disagree with me and say contradictory things, rather than that I, being one man, should be discordant with myself and say contradictory things. That's the choice. You can be out of harmony with the multitude and be true to yourself and true to reason, true to the truth, or you can be in harmony with the fluctuations of public opinion by being out of tune with yourself and out of tune with the truth. That's the issue that he's dealing with. And then what Callicles does is he says, look, Socrates, there are two standards here. One is the standard of convention, and the other is the standard of nature. He says, you are appealing in completely bad faith to conventional standards of morals. And by convention, it's better to suffer injustice than to do it. Okay, that's just because people think that. By nature, it's better to do injustice than to suffer it. And he basically argues that by nature, the strong should rule, the weak should submit, and that the reason why we have conventions that say things to the contrary is that all the weak have gotten together and have created morality to bind the strong. But why? Because it's in their interest to bind the strong, and so people are deluded into thinking that it's wrong to demand more than one's fair share. It's wrong to demand to rule others. It's wrong to demand to get your way at the expense of other people. He says this is just the advantage of the weak speaking. This is just the self-interest of the weak. And this is what convention is, just the self-interest of the weak. Whereas nature teaches that the self-interest of the strong is what's right, and we need to pursue it. And we shouldn't be ashamed of that. So Socrates has to refute this, and he gives a few arguments in refutation of it. And the most important argument really is this. Socrates argues, look, Callicles, you say that the stronger should rule, the superior should rule, the better man should rule, and the better man is the stronger, right? He says, yes. And he says, well, but Callicles, isn't it true that if a whole bunch of weaklings get together, they become stronger, right, than the few who are naturally strong? And therefore, these weaklings, as you put it, create all these rules of justice. And if might makes right, then the rules set up by the weak are right because they together are the mighty. Callicles is just appalled at this argument. Socrates has caught him. And he finally goes on and says, I don't mean just any rabble of slaves and weak men when they get together become strong. He says, what I mean by superiority is ultimately superiority of intellect, and courage. And he says that those who are superior of intellect, and by intellect here he means practical reason, those who are superior in practical reason and courage should rule and get more. And Socrates says, well, wait a second here, Callicles. If what you're really appealing to is some kind of notion of wisdom, right, that the wiser should rule, the ones who have more practical savvy, right, should rule, then it doesn't make any sense to say that they should get more. What it makes sense to say is that they should get the wise amount. Right. So, for instance, among the sick, the doctor rules, because the doctor is wisest in treating the sick. And you would have to think that a doctor was completely mad if he were to say things like this, you know, this guy is getting one foot amputated, and I want more, so I chop off two of mine, right? Obviously not, that would be mad. Or this person is getting three Valium, but I'm better than they are, so I want six. Again, that would be mad, especially if you don't need Valium at all. So what Socrates is saying is that if wisdom is the standard, then it's the wise proportion that one should want for oneself, not the biggest portion. And one would only get the biggest portion if it happened to be wisest. He's saying the same thing. What if you're a nutritionist, but you're a small person? And, you know, would the small nutritionist demand to eat more food than the large person, right, who needs more food? No, that'd be crazy. If he were really thinking about nutrition, he would want a smaller portion that's right for him. And again, this bothers Callicles intensely. And Callicles then says, look, all I'm saying, Socrates, is that in the affairs of the city, those who are wisest and most courageous in dealing with political matters should want more. They should rule others, and because they rule others, they should get more. And Socrates then raises a question that's really wonderful, and this is at the bottom of page 83. A little above where it says 491D, Callicles says, but indeed, I have already said, those who are intelligent in regard to the affairs of the city and courageous, for it is fitting that these men rule the cities, and the just is this, that these the rulers have more than the others the ruled. But what in relation to themselves, comrade? Socrates asks. What in the world? Rulers are ruled in relation to themselves. What do you mean? I mean that each one rules himself. Or is there no need of this, that he rule himself, but only that he rule the others? What do you mean, ruling himself? Oh, nothing complicated. But just what the many mean, being moderate and in control of oneself, ruling the pleasures and desires that are in oneself. Callicles says, rather contemptuously, what a pleasant fellow you are. You're saying that the moderate are the foolish. How so? And he goes on, yes, that it is most certainly is, Socrates, since how would a human being become happy while being a slave to anyone at all? No, this is the fine and just according to nature, which I am now telling you outspokenly. The man who will live correctly must let his own desires be as great as possible and not chasten them. And he must be sufficient to serve them when they are as great as possible through courage and intelligence and to fill them up with the things for which desire arises on each occasion. And he goes on to say people who can't do that aren't happy. People with small desires, they're weak. And people who have big desires but can't satisfy them, well, they're unhappy. The best life is the life of a person with enormous appetites and the wherewithal to satisfy them. That's the hedonist credo. And it's obvious that he's thinking in terms of the conventional pleasures. Food, drink, wealth, and so on and so forth. About a third of the way from the bottom of the page, he says, what in truth would be more shameful and worse than moderation and justice for these human beings, namely the stronger ones, and that they, who can enjoy the good things, and with no one blocking their path, should impose a master on themselves, the law and speech and blame of the many human beings, namely conventional notions of propriety and moderation. Or how would they not have become wretched under the sway of this fine thing, justice and moderation, when they distribute nothing more to their own friends than to enemies, and this while ruling in their own city? But in truth, Socrates, which you claim to pursue, this is how it is. Luxury, intemperance, and freedom when they have support. This is virtue and happiness. And those other things, the fine pretenses, the agreements of human beings against nature, are drivel and worth nothing. So here it is, laid out, and this is a pretty, you know, well-put case for hedonism. Socrates is really raising a very wonderful and powerful question, though, and the question is this. What entitles a person to rule over other people? Is it possible for a person to be a good ruler of others if they're a terrible ruler of themselves? Right? If a person can't exercise self-control in the simplest matters, like eating, how can they exercise control over others in great affairs of state? Take a hypothetical politician.
But
there are many, many politicians like this in our history. Lyndon Johnson was one. President Kennedy was another. People who were gluttonous in their feeding habits, eat 8 or 10 hamburgers at a sitting or something like that. Helmut Kohl of Germany was this way too. Just glutton on a fantastic scale. Everyone around him was always astonished by his lack of self-control and his eating habits. Chasing skirts. Many politicians, when they become powerful, immediately start, behaving like alpha gorillas and chasing around as many females as they possibly can. If you see people if you see people with the pretense of being able to rule others, completely incapable of ruling themselves, on things that are rather easy to rule oneself on, namely one's desires, one simply says, well, no, I'm not going to do this. It's certainly harder to rule involuntary, functions of the body, right? Than voluntary things. And if they can't rule themselves in these areas, what qualifies them to rule over anybody else or anything else? I mean, that's a great question. And if you look at most of history, you find that that's a question that could be posed to quite a lot of people who became rulers. Mussolini had 169 mistresses. How can he rule over others if he can't rule over himself? And he was also married at the time, too. So he didn't have the excuse of being single. It's rather extraordinary. There have been quite a few Oriental despots who had hundreds or thousands of wives and concubines. And many of them actually were put to use. Others, were just decorative or gifts, the tribute, right, from vassals. They would send some pretty girl, and that would be about all there was to it. She would just go off and be a sort of decorative object at some potentate's court. But others were actually, making use of all these people. And you have to say there's something just ghastly and immoderate about that kind of behavior. What qualifies them to rule over others. So anyway, Socrates then launches on his critique of hedonism. And there are basically four arguments here. And I just want to lay them out on the board because reading through the give and take of the discussion would become tedious. And so let's just lay them out, and then what I can do is just discuss them with you. So the first argument goes like this. The good, which is equal to happiness, and the bad, which is rendered as wretchedness here. Just bear with me when you see this long premise. Okay? Cannot exist in
the same person at the same time and in the same respect.
Premise two.
Pleasure and pain, understood as satisfaction and desire, can exist in the same person at the same time. And I'm just going to put this in brackets because it's somewhat questionable. And the same respect. I'm not sure if this is part of Socrates' argument or not. There might be a good reason why it's not. Therefore, the conclusion is simple. The good is not the same as pleasure. The bad is not the same as pain. Okay, so, let's interpret this all. The good or happiness and the bad or wretchedness cannot exist in the same person at the same time and in the same respect. First of all, let's understand happiness and wretchedness are not being defined here in terms of pleasure and pain. That's the whole point, is to argue that they're not the same. So let's just use a very general notion of well-being versus a sense of lack of well-being. Now, a person cannot experience wretchedness and happiness at the same time in the same respect. What does that mean? Well, it means that you cannot be wretched and happy about the same thing in the same way. Now, you might say, well, wait a second here. I can remember instances where I was really, really unhappy and really happy about the very same thing. Right? For instance, say that you're leaving for a new country. Right? You're moving overseas. Right? You're leaving your homeland. You're emigrating somewhere else. And you really want to do this, and so you're happy about it. But on the other hand, you're leaving home, and that makes you unhappy. Well, Socrates would say, that is all well and good, but are you happy and unhappy about the very same aspects of what you're doing? Really, you're happy that you're doing something that you want to do, namely leaving, but you're unhappy about the other side of it, which is going, right? And those are two different aspects of the same thing, right? But he said it wouldn't be possible for you to be happy and unhappy about the very same aspect of what's happening. And if you did find mixed emotions, that's because, well, there are different aspects of the thing that you feel differently about. However, it is the case that pleasure and pain, and he understands pleasure here as the satisfaction of desire and pain as desire. Okay? Pleasure and pain can exist in the same person at the same time. And he gives, as his example, slaking your thirst. If you're thirsty, that's a form of pain, right? And if you drink, that gives you a certain pleasure. Now, when you're drinking, you're feeling both pain and pleasure at the same time. You're feeling thirsty, and you're satisfying your thirst at the same time. And so, and it's in a way, in the same respect, because it's your thirst and the satiation of the thirst that are both pleasurable and painful at the same time. And when you cease drinking, okay, right, when you're full, you're no longer feeling either the pleasure of drinking or the pain of thirst, right? And at that point, an additional glass of water would be actually a source of pain, right? No more, I'm full, right? So, whenever it comes to pleasures of the body, if you will, and pains of the body, they can exist at the same time, and I would argue in the same respect. And therefore, they're different from happiness and unhappiness, right? The good and the bad. You can have good things and bad things, but not at the same time and in the same respect. You can have pleasure and pain at the same time and in the same respect. Therefore, they have different ways of existence, or modes of existence, right? They have different modes of being, and they can't be the same thing. Well, let's go on to the second argument. The second argument is related. The good, or happiness, right, and the bad, wretchedness, do not cease at the same time, but in succession. The cessation of the good being bad, vice versa.
Okay, so we're talking now not about existing together at the same time, but talking about lapsing out of existence, ceasing, right? He's saying that just as the good and the bad do not exist at the same time and in the same respect, in the same person, so they do not disappear at the same time, right? If they can't exist together at the same time, then they can't disappear at the same time. Rather, they exist successively, so that when you're happy and your happiness ceases, then wretchedness happens, right? And when you're wretched and your wretchedness ceases, that's because it's being replaced by happiness. So they don't exist simultaneously, they exist successively. Now, pleasure and pain, satisfaction and desire, cease at the same time. And I already sort of explained what that means. When you're thirsty and you start drinking, you're feeling simultaneously the pain of thirst and the pleasure of satisfaction. But when the thirst goes away, so does the pleasure of drinking. This always happens at holiday meals, at least for me. You know, because, you know, it's tradition to pile it on, right? And at a certain point, you know, when people start passing this food around again and again, it becomes repulsive. What once was a source of pleasure due to the pain of hunger now becomes a source of pain because you just don't have any use for it anymore. And the idea of consuming one more helping of turkey is gross. Therefore, the good is not the same as pleasure, and the bad is not the same as pain. Again, what he's showing is they have different ways of existing in time. The good and the bad can't exist at the same time or cease at the same time. They exist successively, not simultaneously. Pleasure and pain can exist and cease simultaneously. Okay? Therefore, they're not the same thing. The good is not the pleasurable, the bad is not the painful. Socrates does give one more argument, and Callicles tries to object to it, but in a way that completely destroys his argument. So let me give the third argument here.
This new argument has three premises. Good things are good because of the presence of goodness. That's the secret ingredient. You go on a tour of Coca-Cola and ask, what's the secret ingredient? Goodness. We have goodness. Bad things are bad because early childhood trauma. Because of the presence of badness. These are highly controversial premises here. But good people and bad people remain good and bad when they experience pleasures and pains. Therefore, pleasure does not cause goodness, and pain does not cause badness.
Now, this is an interesting argument. First of all, the first two premises are just pure Plato.
Right?
Plato argues that things have particular characters because they somehow participate in what he calls the ideas of the good or the bad. Now, you don't have to bring in his whole metaphysics, though, to grant some truth to these premises. If something is good, it's because it has a quality of goodness about it. And if you were to take away its goodness, it wouldn't be good anymore. Right? It's just like saying that this table is brown because it has some brownness to it. If you take away the brownness, it's no longer going to be brown. Now, it is a fact, however, that good men and bad men both undergo pleasures and pains. But the bad men aren't made good by enjoying pleasures, and good men aren't made bad by suffering pains. So, if goodness is what makes a person good, and pleasure is the good, then wouldn't you expect that enjoying pleasures would make a person good? Would make a bad person good? So all we would need to do is take all these people out of maximum security prisons, send them to massage parlors or to Club Med or, you know, on Carnival cruises, you know, give them gold cards and send them shopping, you know, and let them enjoy the pleasures of life and they become better men. Well, it doesn't work that way. But don't let this get out, because God knows we don't need another crazy proposal floating around our penal, our justice system. And by the same token, there are many good people who suffer pain in life, right? Good people get cancer just like bad people. Good people get hit with cars just like bad people. But a good person who suffers pain does not thereby become a bad person. So pain obviously can't be the same as badness, because pain doesn't make good people bad. Bad things, painful events, don't make people bad. Now, you could ask questions like this. I mean, there are objections you could pose. The other night, when I went through this argument in connection with the Plato class, somebody said, well, what about a person who experiences terrible things and is traumatized and so forth, and it breaks them? And I guess the way Socrates would handle that is to say, well, they weren't really that good to begin with. They might have been a fairly weak person, right, who just never cracked because they had a fairly easy time. You know, they were protected, in a sense, by a fairly easy environment. And then something really bad happens, and it showed that they were actually made out of fairly weak stuff. Okay, and they finally cracked. Whereas there are other people who have basically stronger characters who, when they undergo bad situations, you discover that they are made out of fairly strong stuff, right? And it's really tragedy and hardship that tests us. And so it's possible for a person to be fairly weak and yet to be going along well in life because they've been lucky so far. I mean, I think that's how Socrates would answer it. So that the person who is broken by painful experiences might not be as strong in their character as a person who isn't already. It doesn't make them have a weak character, but it's the weakness that's already there that's becoming manifest for the first time under extraordinary strains. I mean, that's how he might handle that sort of objection. Now, at this point, Callicles, with a great deal of sarcasm, accuses Socrates of just pretending that, you know, going along and making his argument as if people didn't recognize that some pleasures are better than others and some pains are better than others. And at this point, Socrates has him. Because if you want to argue that pleasure is the same as the good, you can't claim that there are good and bad pleasures, right? Anything that's a pleasure would have to be good. And therefore, the idea of a bad pleasure would be simply nonsensical to a hedonist. Right? By the same token, if pain is the bad, then there can't be such thing as good pains. And if you admit that there are good pains, you can't define the pain as the bad. Right? And so what Callicles does in trying to defend himself is he surrenders, in effect. And of course, and Socrates, basically informs him of this fact, much to his displeasure. Because, for instance, if you're contemplating a wide array of pleasures to enjoy, and you say, well, I think I'll enjoy that, but I'm going to leave that aside because this is good and that's bad, that means there's another standard that you're appealing to over and above pleasure that helps you distinguish between the good pleasures and the bad pleasures. And if you are contemplating pains to suffer, right? We do that when we contemplate, say, taking out mortgages or visiting relatives. That involves, or taking trips. I mean, that involves certain amounts of pain. You do have to say, well, this is a good pain. I'm willing to undergo this. I'm willing to go to the dentist. I'm willing to go back home for 10 days. I'm willing to do this. I'm willing to go to this funeral, even though it'll be a painful experience, because it's a good pain. Birth pangs, I mean, those are pains too, right? But women regularly choose to undergo this because they think that they're good pains. And if they're good pains, then pain can't be the definition of the bad. So, Anyway, this is how Socrates handles this argument. But Callicles is a very eloquent proponent of this view. He doesn't really argue for it, but what he says is very plausible to many people, and if you find people defending hedonism, they're going to say, look, you know, all of these notions that it's not nice to be greedy, it's not nice to be horny, it's not nice to do all these things, this is mere convention foisted upon the strong, people with big appetites by the weak. Very common attitude. And if a person can see through these mere conventions, then they will lead a better life by satisfying their desires, by letting their desires grow and satisfying them. The things to satisfy yourself with, well, they're the natural desires. And people have natural desires for food and drink and shelter. The problem, though, is this. When these sophists like Callicles begin arguing for hedonism on the basis of the distinction between nature and convention, they immediately start bringing in things that aren't natural. And so to look at the list that he gave earlier, at the bottom of page 84, he talks about luxury. Well, there's nothing natural about luxury, right? Where do we have genes for driving luxury cars? You know, what's the gene to make women desire to wear rubies the size of bird eggs? You know, and things like that. There was this documentary on the Queen of England done in the late 60s. It was very interesting. It was the first time anything like this had ever been done. And there's this one scene which got a lot of comments, and she was with her dresser. This woman she called Bobo, who was one of her closest friends throughout her entire life, they were looking through jewels to put on for some dinner or something, and she pulls out of this case this necklace with these gigantic rubies that were the size, you know, they were huge. She's looking at it and admiring it, and she says. And she drops it back, and she turns to her dresser, and she says, I have actually worn this, haven't I? Mm-hmm. She couldn't remember. She had so many. Well, why do people... There's no gene for accumulating things like that, and there's no gene for valuing these things. But that's one of the things that Callicles would think that a person in a position of power would want to have. The biggest jewels, the biggest cars, the most mistresses, the biggest feasts. None of these are natural. And so this is where, you know, the argument from natural, the superiority of natural desires and the rightness of satisfying natural desires seems to be departed from or contradicted by these voluptuous sorts of hedonists.
Right.
And this is what leads us to the next topic, which will be the more ascetic kinds of hedonists, namely the Epicureans. Because Epicurus, the famous hedonist, the man whose name is synonymous with pleasure-seeking, lived in a tiny little hut and ate gruel, and thought that cheese was a luxury that he could only afford to permit himself on very special occasions. But why did he do this? Because he was more committed to living in accordance with nature than Callicles here is. More committed to satisfying natural desires than Callicles was. And what he did is he took an inventory of his desires and simply eliminated all the ones that were unnatural. And as it turned out, all he needed was a roof over his head, enough food to keep his body functioning, and friends. That's all he needed. That's all that was left when he went through his desires. So let me just read where Socrates sums everything up nicely. This is Socrates in Praise of Moderation. It's on page 104 to 105. About a third of the way down 104, Callicles says, speak, good man, and finish it yourself. He doesn't want to finish the argument. Listen to me take up the argument from the beginning. Are the pleasant and the good the same thing? No, not the same. Must the pleasant be done for the sake of the good, or the good for the sake of the pleasant? The pleasant for the sake of the good. You choose your pleasures in order to advance the cause of goodness. If there are bad pleasures, you forego them.
And is the pleasant this thing through which we are pleased, when it comes to be present? And is the good that through which we are good when it is present? Certainly. But surely we are good, both we and all other things that are good, when some virtue comes to be present. It seems necessary to me, Callicles.
Socrates goes on, he says, the virtue of each thing, each implement, each body, and the soul too, and every living thing, does not come to be present in the finest manner, simply at random, but by arrangement, correctness, and art. Then is the virtue of each thing something that has been arranged and ordered? Yes. Is it therefore a certain order arising in each thing, each thing's own order, that makes each of the beings good? He's saying, yes. What he's saying is that the goodness of a thing is of the proper ordering of its soul. Or you know, if it has a soul, right? If it's just an inanimate object, if it's a tool, its proper ordering its goodness is the proper ordering of its parts. As a good tape recorder works, a broken tape recorder just sort of rattles. Okay, when you pick it up, because the parts don't mesh anymore. Okay. And then he goes on. Then is a soul too that has its own order better than a disordered one? Necessarily. And surely the one that has order is orderly. Well, how could it not be? And the orderly soul is moderate, very necessarily. The moderate soul is therefore good. And this is what he was arguing. This was the topic of the argument. The moderate soul, not the pleasure-loving soul, is the good soul. And then he argues the reverse, that the bad soul is the immoderate soul, the soul that's dragged around by its pleasures, by its desires. Socrates, the top of 105, goes on. He says, I say that then, that if the moderate soul is good, then the one suffering from the opposite to the moderate is bad, and this would be the foolish and intemperate soul. And surely the moderate man would do fitting things concerning both gods and human beings, for he who does unfitting things would not show moderation. And surely he who does fitting things concerning human beings would do just things. And so what Socrates does is he tries to show that if you start out with one virtue, moderation, you're going to find all the other virtues are necessitated along with it. And so the truly healthy soul is not just the moderate soul, but the just soul, the courageous soul, and the wise soul, because the four main virtues are wisdom, courage, justice, and moderation. And so he argues that point. And again, a soul without any of these things is going to be a disorderly soul, a bad soul, and it's therefore going to be unhappy. Let me just read you this last line. So it is very necessary, Callicles, that the moderate man, as we have described him, since he is just, courageous, and pious, must be the completely good man, and the good man must do what he does well and nobly, and the man who does well must be blessed and happy, while the base man who does badly must be wretched. And this would be the one in an opposite condition to the moderate man, the intemperate man, who you were praising. So this is how he sums it all up.